Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many years ago, Riley Knight completed a degree in history. This proved to be a bad move, as it was absolutely useless for him. Until now, here's some half-assed history.
What's going on, mate? Great to have you along for some more half-assed history. This week on the agenda, we're going to be continuing our chat about the history of the United States of America. We started this last week, of course, talking about the indigenous inhabitants of the continent, and then we talked through the initial colonization of the East Coast, the establishment of the 13 colonies that would rise in rebellion against the British, and then we also talked about the War of Independence fought during the American Revolution and what happened in its immediate aftermath with the establishment of a brand new constitution to govern this brand new nation. And that's where we left the story in part one, and it's time to now continue the story, moving into the 19th century and talking about the challenges that the US faced immediately after its creation and the issues that defined its history in the first half of this century. And these challenges, these issues, namely, were its foreign policy, its westward expansion and how this expansion affected Indigenous Americans, and of course, the institution of slavery. And talking about slavery will very neatly bring us to the Civil War, which we'll, again, also talk about today. And then next week, we'll move into the Reconstruction era and beyond towards the 20th century. So if you're interested in any of these topics, then this is the episode for you. And while I'd say it's probably advisable to go back and listen to part one, it's by no means necessary to understand much of the, you know, importance of the historical issues that are in play here in this episode. But before we begin, a couple of things. Again, as I said last week, I want to make it clear that I really can't hope to be comprehensive in these episodes, given that this is a broad overview of, you know, centuries and centuries of history. But I will say that I have gone a little bit deeper here and there when certain issues warrant it. And I also want to say that I'm very appreciative of all of the feedback I've received from people over the past week or so in the wake of the first part of the history of the United States, the episode I put out last week. Very appreciative of all the feedback, both positive and negative. And particularly, I want to thank all the Americans who have weighed in. I'd like to think that I'm not speaking from ignorance on this topic when talking about the history of the US. Not only have I studied US history at university, I've also lived in the United States. I lived there for a while. I also visit the US reasonably often, even these days. I was there last week. I was over in Seattle. And I have a great many American friends that I enjoy discussing issues like the ones we're going to get into today. And I'm saying all this because I want to make it clear to any Americans listening that my objective here isn't to disparage or to insult the United States or Americans in general. And I know that it might come off like that. And so I apologize. I apologize to the Americans who are listening. But I want to say as gently as possible, right, that the reason that what I'm saying may come off as insulting to you and your country is because in many cases, the history that you were taught about your nation in school was not necessarily as rigorous or as truthful as it should have been. There are a great many great things about the United States and its history. And look, I'll point them out just as I point out its failings and its flaws. And I do hope that this is at least something of a balanced perspective on the history of the United States. That is, you know, until we start talking about Andrew Jackson, because I tell you what, I've got nothing good to say about that bloody hell. Anyway, With all that said, let's get into the episode here. Let's get underway with the second episode of our four-part series on the history of the United States of America. Here we go. We're going all the way back. We're going all the way back to 1789. This is where we left off last week, the year that George Washington became the first president of the United States under its newly adopted constitution. And I'll tell you this, while Washington was far from a perfect man, he was a pretty bloody good president, and he set a great number of very important precedents, political precedents, for the young country. The United States had been struggling after gaining its independence due to a lack of a strong central government. And the Washington administration, I tell you what, it bloody well fixed that problem. Washington helped to establish the federal government as a powerful political institution within the United States governmental system, rather than one that was sort of, you know, secondary to the states politically. And this was done mainly through economic means. Washington's federal government established the Bank of the United States, the nation's first national bank, and took on all the debts of all of the states. And this steadied the economic instability that the young country had been grappling with and empowered the federal government to act decisively and effectively on behalf of all of the states as one coherent political unit. The federal government was able to fund itself by imposing tariffs on foreign trade, and into the 1790s, the US was in a much better spot than it had been before this. Its capital moved from New York to Philadelphia, and then later on, of course, to Washington, D.C. And despite a rebellion here or a conflict there, the strong central federal government helped to set the US on its way. However, there were those who didn't like a strong federal government, and there was a vocal political faction that wanted to see curbs and limitations on governmental power. And this faction, this led to two very important things taking place. Firstly, in 1791, a series of 10 amendments were made to the US Constitution, known as the Bill of Rights. Now, the Bill of Rights is another famous and immensely important document in US history. The US Bill of Rights has gone on to inspire countless other similar documents in nations all throughout the world, although, sadly, not Australia. We don't have constitutionally guaranteed rights in the same way that Americans do. We have some, but they're not particularly robust. And honestly, our Constitution is very much lacking in the protection of personal liberties, in guaranteed rights for Australian citizens. So we certainly have something to learn when it comes to the protection of individual liberties from the United States and documents like the Bill of Rights. Because there's truly some terrific stuff in the US Bill of Rights. The First Amendment, for instance, an absolute all-time. Have a listen to this. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press or the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. Enshrining freedom of speech and all these other freedoms as the First Amendment to the United States Constitution, a huge step, a massive step in ensuring that these liberal values, the protection of core human rights, was normalized in democratic societies. And fans of free speech all around the world have a lot to thank the United States for in enshrining this cornerstone of modern democratic society as the very first amendment that they made to their constitution. And the Fourth and the Fifth and the Sixth Amendments are also absolute bangers, dealing with legal process and the legal rights that citizens have when accused of a crime or going through a court proceeding, a trial. But then there are others that perhaps aren't as beneficial, namely, of course, the Second Amendment. Now, I've had a lot of conversations with a lot of Americans about the Second Amendment from people all across the spectrum of opinions on this issue. And what's really surprising to me is that some of the Americans I've spoken to that don't own guns, that don't want to own guns, that don't see the need for people to own guns generally, are still in favor of this amendment. Because to much of the rest of the world, the Second Amendment seems like complete lunacy. Here in Australia, for instance, across most of Europe, there is largely no issue with very strict gun control that is widely in place, most people are in strong support of legislation that keeps guns out of the hands of ordinary people. But Americans just bloody love their guns. And it's a very uniquely American thing to think that without the right to bear arms, your nation, I don't know, immediately becomes unfree. And I don't know, I still remember the very first time I saw someone in the United States walking around with a gun. I went to get a Baconator at a Wendy's in Phoenix, Arizona, and a guy just walked in with a gun on his hip. I was terrified. It was just like normal for everyone else that was there, but I felt so anxious and afraid that I just had to get up and leave. I left the Wendy's and didn't look back. I couldn't believe how everyone else there didn't even bat an eyelid. But there are lots of things that Americans seem to consider normal that are extremely weird to the rest of the world. The Pledge of Allegiance, for instance, or, I don't know, the huge gap in cubicle doors that American toilets always seem to have. But the country's dogged preservation of the Second Amendment is baffling. It's absolutely baffling because, as every single Western liberal democracy demonstrates, you just don't need guns in a free and democratic society. And the harm that they can bring, the harm that they do to just people peacefully living their lives, is immense and something that unfortunately is all too normalized within the United States, again, because of the fact that this Second Amendment was put in place and has stuck around for so very long. Anyway, the Bill of Rights was one of the things to come of remember I said this faction that disliked the strong central government. The Bill of Rights was put in place to make sure that this strong central government wouldn't trample on the rights of its citizenry. But there was another thing that was potentially equally as important and also equally as long-lasting as the Bill of Rights, a political institution that has stuck around in different forms to this very day, the two-party political system that has dominated US politics more or less since the nation's inception. There have been six party systems over the history of the United States as parties have, you know, come and gone or realigned themselves in response to certain issues, but broadly speaking, there have always been two major parties representing two sides of the political divide. And the first political, the first party system began with the establishment of the, funnily enough, the Democratic Republican Party, which may come as something of a surprise to fans of, you know, the modern US political system, given that there is the Democratic Party and the Republican Party. But no, one of the first political parties in the United States was called the Democratic Republican Party, and it was founded by Thomas Jefferson and James Madison, both of whom would go on to become presidents, of course. And in opposition to the Democratic Republican Party, Alexander Hamilton, Washington's protege and the founder of the Bank of the United States, he founded the Federalist Party. Now, it is really, really, really important here. It's really important to recognize that political values have shifted immensely since the time that the United States was founded. And the traditional political left-right dichotomy that we have today looked very, very different back then. For one, it barely existed. The left-right political divide came out of the French Revolution, so it's very much in its infancy when we're talking about early United States history. But more importantly, opinions that might today be labelled left-wing could very much be right-wing back then, and vice versa. And plenty of political identities held what would today be considered views from opposing political camps back then. To illustrate my point, this might sound a bit confusing, right? But I'll try to illustrate my point, right? The Democratic Republicans, the so-called left-wing party of the time, they supported a great many values that would today be considered right-wing. They were the party of small government and free markets. But back then, these were left-wing values. They were progressive. They were challenging. They were forward-thinking. But in addition to these, by now, quite conservative values, you know, we think about economic conservatism involving free markets. We think about small government champions generally being conservative. But back then, the Democratic Republicans not only supported these values, but also stuff that we still consider broadly to be under the umbrella of left-wing politics, individual liberties, liberalism in general, equal rights, that sort of thing. And This is all in contrast to the Federalists, who were the right-wing party back then. They championed a strong central government, which was a right-wing value back in those times, but were in favour of big business, economic protectionism, military affairs, that sort of thing. As the two-party divide established itself, Washington was officially neutral, although his sympathies were generally with Federalists, but never to the point that he accepted the label of being a Federalist, and indeed, when he left office, his famous farewell address warned the nation of the dangers of political tribalism and divided political parties. Words that have probably ended up being a lot truer than Washington would have hoped for as he left office after two terms. And I will say this as well. Washington set a very important precedent when he left office after his second term, because he could have sought a third term. He could have sought maybe a fourth term after that. The bloke was immensely popular and united people across the political spectrum in the United States due to his status as, you know, the commander-in-chief of the Continental Army, his enormous political legacy as the first president. But he didn't seek a third term. He did not. And this became something of a tradition. No president until Franklin Roosevelt in the 20th century ever served more than two terms. And after Roosevelt, the two-term limit was added officially. It wasn't just a political convention. It was added officially with an amendment to the Constitution. And today, legally speaking at least, no president can serve more than two terms according to this constitutional amendment, which is based on the precedent, right, the convention that was set as Washington willfully and quite, I think, gratefully after a very long political career, handed away power to his successor John Adams after the election in 1796. But history marched on after Washington's presidency, as immensely important as it was in establishing the United States as an independent and self-sufficient nation. Washington remains one of the most favorably ranked U.S. presidents in history as a result of his work as president. But as I say, history marched on, and the United States had to meet new issues and new challenges as time continued. And to talk about these issues, we're going to have a bit of a change of pace here, because rather than the general chronological overview that we've had so far, we've been following, you know, the US year by year, decade by decade, we're going to take a slightly different tack. We're going to talk about three distinct topics and work our way through them individually until we arrive at the American Civil War. So, to address the first half of the 19th century when it comes to US history, we're firstly going to talk about the nation's foreign relations. Then we'll come back and talk about its westward expansion and the impact that this had on Indigenous Americans. And then finally, we'll come back once again to talk about slavery, which will, of course, bring us to the Civil War. So, starting in 1800, with the defeat of the presidential one-term wonder John Adams by Thomas Jefferson, let's talk about the foreign relations of the United States in the first half of the 19th century. The United States was still a very young nation at this time, and globally speaking, a rather unimportant one. It was still finding its feet on the international stage. And while the Federalists were generally in favour of closer links with Britain, despite the enmity brought on by the Revolutionary War, Jefferson and his Democratic Republicans, they weren't so hot on the British. Jefferson and his successors, Madison, Munro, and John Quincy Adams, they were all Democratic Republicans as well. And this meant that the United States was initially dominated by the values of the Democratic Republicans in the wake of Jefferson. Jefferson weakened the federal government and its judiciary. He sought to curb the power of not just politicians, but also bankers and industrialists. Instead, he worked to expand the nation's territory. He wanted the political heartland of the United States to be out in the fields and the farms. We'll come to what the implications of this expansion of territory was in due course, of course. But Jefferson's quest to expand the United States did involve very strong engagement with certain foreign powers, just not, you know, Britain. Perhaps the most famous legacy of Jefferson's presidency when it comes to foreign affairs was the Louisiana Purchase, which saw the United States more or less double its territory after buying what was nominally French-possessed land to the west of the United States in 1803. The US maintained a very good relationship with France throughout its early history. France, of course, had been instrumental in the United States achieving its independence and statehood, and the Americans didn't forget this. While the explicit alliance between the two nations lapsed as the Napoleonic Wars began, the United States remained nominally neutral during this conflict. The United States and France remained on generally good terms, and the Louisiana Purchase reflected this. And more broadly, Jefferson and his successors sought to expand foreign trade and become more involved in world affairs, although principally economically, not so much when it came to military affairs. But the most notable event when it comes to U.S. foreign relations in the early 19th century was the War of 1812. The War of 1812 was fought between the United States and Britain, and it was fought due to... I don't know where to start, to be honest. It was fought due to the British impressment of American sailors to fight in the Napoleonic Wars, the British supporting indigenous Americans who were hostile to the United States as they expanded westward, the British interfering with American trade as they attempted to expand their trade network across the globe, principally to, you know, rivals of the British on the European continent. And so the Americans, then led by President James Madison at the time, they'd had a gutful, and so they went to war in 1812. And long story short, it was a draw, although there were some very interesting and very amusing stories to come from the War of 1812, like how the British raided Washington, D.C., burnt the Capitol building, and ate dinner in the White House, or how the U.S. invaded Canada, or how the Americans got their national anthem, the Star-Spangled Banner, when a bloke named Francis Scott Key watched the British bombardment of Fort McHenry in Baltimore and wrote a poem about it. Or how a bloke by the name of Andrew Jackson made his name as a war hero in the Battle of New Orleans, something that would go on to have very important repercussions for the country, which we will come to in due course. All of these stories and more in Episode 8, The War of 1812. Get across it, although... Before we get across it, I will warn you, it's a little rough. Those early episodes, I was still figuring things out. Anyway, in the end, neither the British or the Americans made all that much headway in the war, and while both sides claimed to have won the war, it was essentially a stalemate. By the time they called it off in 1815, it was just a draw. Although there was definitely a feeling of victory throughout the United States, they had at least defended themselves from a major international power. So, you know, I guess you could call that a dub. And it certainly bolstered the young nation's confidence on the world stage and helped it to establish itself more strongly amongst the international community. And at home, the supposed victory that the Americans had had during the... Well, look, it wasn't a defeat. And I guess, you know, they were counting that as a win. It brought about a period known as the Era of Good Feelings. And this wasn't just due to the fact that they had not lost the War of 1812. The Federalist Party was crumbling. They had largely failed to maintain or pursue their political aims in the wake of the Washington presidency. They hadn't had a president in the White House for a very long time and were slowly losing their political... Well, not even slowly, really. By the end of the War of 1812, they just didn't have any political relevance whatsoever. In the wake of this, Madison's successor, James Monroe, he made concerted efforts to do away with political parties altogether. So no wonder it was the Era of Good Feelings. There wasn't this us versus them mentality for a little while, at least, there wasn't. It almost worked, but the second party system came along after Monroe's presidency when the Democratic-Republican Party, which had been in the White House for a very long time, split into factions. The Democratic Party, led by Andrew Jackson, and the Whig Party, led by Henry Clay and other opponents of the Jacksonian Democrats, defined the second party system. And we'll come back to Jackson and his Democrats, because they were a very different party to today's Democrats, as you'll see. But to continue the story instead of U.S. foreign policy, let's talk about Monroe. Because in 1823, towards the end of his presidency, Monroe established a very, very important piece of U.S. foreign policy known as the Monroe Doctrine. Now, the Monroe Doctrine made clear the United States' strong opposition to European colonialism or political interference throughout the Americas, North, Central, and South. Around this time, many Latin American nations were pursuing independence from their European, mainly Spanish, imperial overlords, and the United States were in support of this, of diminishing European influence across the Americas. The Monroe Doctrine said that any European meddling in the Americas would be interpreted as a hostile act against the United States itself, a stark warning that was at the time roundly ignored by all the major European powers. Don't forget, the United States, still a complete minnow on the international stage. It was not a powerful nation by any stretch. Its military capabilities were laughable compared to the might of the European great powers. But all the same, the Monroe Doctrine went on to have a very strong influence on the general development of US foreign policy for centuries to come, because it very clearly divided the world, I guess you want to say, or at least this part of the world, between the Americas and Europe as two separate spheres of influence. And Monroe, as the President of the United States and many of his successors, began to take a larger role in taking responsibility for the political affairs of the Americas, as distinct from the years and centuries previous where Europeans and European powers had had an enormous amount of political influence on the other side of the Atlantic. So it set a precedent that future, not all of them, but many future presidents would follow. And through to this very day, right, it's been invoked by modern presidents to justify the pursuit of their respective political agendas. All the way through to the 20th century, the Monroe Doctrine has not lost its relevance. And even into the 21st century, you can see echoes of the United States and its foreign policy objectives tracing their lineage, I guess, back to Monroe and his very stark warning about foreign interference in the American continents. In any case, the Monroe Doctrine, it has certainly helped to establish the United States and the Americas more broadly as existing within their own sphere of influence. And as I say, this would go on to strongly influence the histories of not just the United States, but nations across the Americas as a result. Anyway, to wrap up the story of pre-Civil War U.S. foreign policy, throughout the 1830s and 1840s, the United States came into conflict with their neighbors to the south in Mexico. And as this is closely linked to what we're going to talk about next in the US, coming to the westward expansion of the US, we'll mainly focus on the story then. But to sort of give it to you in a nutshell here, Mexico's territory used to extend a lot further north than it does today. And as the US pushed westward, these two nations came into conflict. And we've actually talked about this period already a little bit in episode 72, the Battle of the Alamo, and episode 246, Antonio Lopez de Santa Anna. So you can go back and get across them for more detail. Or, alternatively, for less detail, you can continue to listen to this episode as we begin now to talk about US westward expansion.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
So, back to 1800 again now to examine this period through a different lens, perhaps the most important lens when it comes to this particular chapter in United States history, as I mentioned, westward expansion. This is what defined the United States throughout the first half of the 19th century. This was at the center of more or less every single major political issue that the country had to face, including, as we'll come to, slavery. But we can begin this discussion about westward expansion that the United States underwent during the first half of the 19th century by talking more about the Louisiana Purchase, which was made, as I said, in 1803. Thomas Jefferson bought 2.1 million square kilometers of territory off the French for the bargain bin basement price of $15 million US dollars. Before the Louisiana Purchase, the territory claimed or controlled by the United States extended to the Mississippi River. Everything east of the Mississippi was under the at least nominal control of Washington. That's the city. Sorry, not the president. He's out of the picture. He's off with Martha and enjoying his retirement. The United States stretched to Illinois, to Tennessee, to Mississippi. But with the Louisiana Purchase, right, the U.S. more or less doubled overnight, expanding out to what is today Montana, Wyoming, Colorado, Oklahoma. Now, there are some important things to note here when talking about the Louisiana Purchase. France didn't actually control most of this area that they sold. They just bagged it. They had painted the map, a very common and very effective technique employed by colonial powers that said, this is ours, you can't have it. And when the US did take possession of this territory from the French after buying it for, again, an absolute bargain, it ended up being a couple of cents per acre. It's not as if the Americans, you know, immediately took control over every square inch of this part of the world either. They did in name. They painted the map. They changed the color of the map, of course. But honestly, for the first little while, that was about it. Although, importantly, it did get the United States the very important port city of New Orleans, which still celebrates its French heritage to this day, as it of course began as a French settlement. But yes, while the United States had official sovereignty over this land, it was actually really under the control of various indigenous inhabitants. Jefferson sent out the famous Lewis and Clark expedition to explore this newly acquired territory, and then American settlers followed in their wake, along with the US Army, who built outposts and forts to establish American control. Indigenous people in this region, they had the broad support of the British. Remember, the War of 1812 was in part caused by the British supporting indigenous people hostile to the United States. The British didn't want the US to expand any further westward. And it wasn't long before the United States came into conflict with indigenous Americans who inhabited the land west of the Mississippi. Of course, back then, the concepts behind indigenous land rights were virtually non-existent, and so countless thousands of indigenous Americans were forcibly removed from their land by the United States. They were forced to pack up and move further westward to make room for newly arrived U.S. settlers. U.S.-controlled territories were established as reservations for indigenous populations, but these populations did not enjoy the protections or the rights of U.S. citizens and were, more often than not, subject to fierce mistreatment before often just being moved on again as the insatiable hunger for more and more land caused more and more settlers to move westward. Settlers poured out west as the years continued. The territory claimed by the United States quickly became properly controlled by it, and more states were admitted to the United States as more land was settled. And consequently, the reservations that had been carved out for indigenous populations shrank. They shrank and shrank, and sadly, it would only get worse from there. And much of that was thanks to, I'm sorry to say, one of the most harmful and destructive presidents in United States history. A president who forever changed the shape and the nature of the nation. A president who is inexplicably honored with a place on the $20 note in America. Andrew Jackson was, in my opinion, one of the most damaging presidents the United States has ever had. After his great victory at the Battle of New Orleans, after establishing himself as a nationally celebrated war hero, he was able to begin a political career that brought far, far more ill to the US than most people realize. Firstly, Jackson greatly expanded the power of the president by really just doing that, really. There wasn't some trick he pulled or anything. He just started to wield executive power like never before, challenging the authority of Congress, challenging the authority of the Supreme Court, shooting first and asking questions later. He freely wielded the presidential veto in pursuing his political aims. He set a brand new precedent for the office of U.S. president. It was now the president, not Congress, that held the real power that would set and pursue a policy agenda. Now, this sounds normal, right, to us today. We know that the United States is defined by its very, very powerful executive branch. The United States president is the most powerful person on earth, they say. They're the ones who dominate US politics. They're the face of the government. Well, the reason that it's so normal now, the reason that the US president wields such supreme executive power, is because Jackson decided that that's what he was going to do, and no one stopped him. It wasn't some cleverly planned, far-sighted reform plan. He just came into office and started wielding power like a sledgehammer, and forever changed, as a result, the landscape of US politics. But this was not the only way that Jackson changed the US political landscape, because as the Democratic-Republican Party began to splinter into factions from 1824 onwards, he also established the Democratic Party, which helped to bring about the second party system that I mentioned before, pitting the Democrats against the Whigs. The Democratic Party is still around today, of course, but I tell you what, I don't think they'd be too quick to celebrate Jackson as their founder, or at least they shouldn't be, because the party looked very, very different back then. Just as, interestingly, the Republican Party did when founded by Abraham Lincoln, although the Republicans are a lot quicker to claim and celebrate Lincoln, despite the vast differences in Lincoln's Republican Party in today's. But so yes, Jackson, he established the Democratic Party as a populist party of the common man, the farmer and the labourer. This was the party for them. He cast himself as being anti-elite, against big government and big banks. And look, while I don't have too much that's complimentary to say about this bloke, I will say this. This bloke did encourage and bring about a new wave of political engagement throughout the United States. He supported extending the vote to, well, adult white men, but still he supported expanding franchise for what it was back then, and he did want people to be involved in politics, and there were some reforms that Jackson brought about that may have been healthy for the United States rather than harmful. But they are so strongly overshadowed by the other elements of his legacy, elements that are so negative, so harmful, so infamous, which we'll talk about now. Firstly, in the wake of Jackson, the Democratic Party became the party of the slaver, supported by white slave owners in the South and their successors, until later party systems reversed this and saw the Democratic Party become, I don't know, more progressive and less overtly racist. But we'll come back to the 19th century Democratic Party as we talk about the Civil War. But its establishment by Jackson, hardly a good thing for the United States in the long run, giving white slavers a banner to rally around and sowing seeds of division on the issue of slavery. But Jackson's most infamous legacy is, of course, his treatment of indigenous Americans. His number one priority after taking office was the displacement and removal of indigenous Americans from the lands that United States settlers were seeking to settle. And he pursued this priority very aggressively through things like the 1830 Indian Removal Act and a process that has become known today as the Trail of Tears. In 1830, Jackson oversaw the passage of legislation that empowered him, the president, to force indigenous Americans off their land, to force them further and further westward to make room for US settlers. Across the United States, but most notably in the Southeast, tens of thousands of indigenous Americans were forcibly removed from their homes and sent westward to reservations, with thousands and thousands of them dying on the way. A lot of terms have been used to describe this process. Forced displacement is amongst the more palatable phrases that are used. But I don't think it's inaccurate to refer to Jackson's policies towards Indigenous Americans as ethnic cleansing or even just genocide. Certainly it was mass murder, as the people of the Cherokee, the Chickasaw, the Choctaw, the Muscogee, and the Seminole nations were forced from their lands by the US Army under threat of violence, and those who wouldn't leave faced destruction and death. These poor people were moved to the Oklahoma Territory, which in turn would later be settled by the United States, and so once again, these indigenous Americans were forcibly displaced in later years, due to the terrible precedents set by presidents such as Andrew Jackson. Look, I know. As an Australian of European descent, I know I don't have a leg to stand on when it comes to talking about the treatment of Indigenous peoples. People like me have benefited from the horrors of colonialism for a very, very long time. But the horrific treatment of Indigenous Americans is a foundational aspect of the nation's history, just as the mistreatment of Indigenous Australians is a foundational aspect of our history. And it astonishes me that the architect and the champion of a systematized campaign of violence and murder and genocide is still honored to this day with his face on American currency. Anyway, even after Jackson left office, the United States continued to expand westward, pushing onwards, buoyed by the idea of manifest destiny. This concept was very influential in turning the United States into what it is today, a vast nation that spans the North American continent from east to west, from Atlantic to Pacific. This was the manifest destiny Americans believed in. They believed their destiny was to claim and to settle the entire breadth of the continent. And of course, in time, that's what they did. Hundreds of thousands of settlers headed west across the 19th century. The Oregon Trail saw people make it all the way to the Pacific. The California Gold Rush saw an explosion in population to the west, eventually making San Francisco the biggest city on the west coast. And as more and more people pushed west, more and more states were established and admitted to the Union, one very notably being Texas, which brings us back to the conflict with Mexico that I talked about earlier. U.S. settlers displaced Mexican settlers in Texas, which eventually established itself as a republic before being annexed by the United States in the mid-1840s. This directly led to the Mexican-American War, which the U.S. very handily won, expanding their territory even further as they took possession of previously Mexican lands in what makes up today's American Southwest, states like California, New Mexico, Utah, Nevada, Arizona, and others. The Gadsden Purchase of 1854 saw the United States buy further territory along the border with Mexico, in what is today Arizona and New Mexico, defining this border as it stands, more or less, to this very day. While to the north, the border with British-controlled Canada was finalised in 1846, 8 years before the Gadsden Purchase. The last section of westward border was finalised by a treaty, eventually leading to the modern-day states of Oregon and Washington. And while the international borders of the United States were more or less set by the time we get to the Civil War in the 1860s, the internal borders of the nation were still very much chopping and changing. The borders of the various states and territories as they were being created didn't look quite like they do today. They were shifting around as new states were created. And it's the creation of new states that, neatly enough, brings us to the final thing that we need to discuss before getting into the Civil War itself, slavery. Because across the first half of the 19th century, slavery became a bigger and bigger issue and actually crystallized over the creation and the admission of new states into the Union. But before we get to that, let's once again wind back the clock, go back to the 1800, or even before 1800, and talk about the institution of slavery across the United States in the years after the establishment of this young nation. Slavery was firmly established as part of the United States by its Constitution, containing, as I mentioned last week, something known as the Three-Fifths Compromise. In the Constitution, or in the original Constitution at least, The Three-Fifths Compromise stated that slaves were, for the purpose of counting population, they were to be considered three-fifths of a person. A despicable law, I'm sure you'll agree, rather obviously, reducing someone to a political entity that is three-fifths of a person is pretty unforgivable, but you might be interested to learn that it was actually those on the anti-slavery side of things that supported this. They were the ones who wanted to reduce the personhood of slaves toiling away in slave states, while the pro-slavery factions within the United States actually wanted slaves to count as a full person. They wanted the slaves that they owned and were forcing to work to be considered people. You might look at that and think, well, that doesn't make any sense at all. Surely the pro-slavery people are going to want to repress and disempower the slaves that they own. Surely they don't want them to have something like personhood when it comes to, you know, political consideration in something like the United States Constitution. But no. Pro-slavery people wanted slaves to be counted amongst state populations because if slaves counted towards population counts, then slave states would have greater representation in Congress because the number of Congress people that each state had was based on its population. And it gets better for the pro-slavery mob because slaves couldn't vote. It would be slave owners that would benefit from increased representation in Congress, and it would make it a lot easier for them to maintain and support and expand pro-slavery ideals and objectives if they controlled more seats in Congress. So, free states, states that were worried about being drowned out in Congress by slave states with high slave populations, they didn't want slaves to count at all. But as a result of the conflict between free states and slave states as the Constitution was being written, the three-fifths compromise was reached, which, as I mentioned, firmly established in the Constitution, quite aside from, you know, the relative personhood of an enslaved person, which is a terrible thing to have to think about. It also firmly established that slavery was an accepted part of the political landscape of the United States from its very conception. Having said that, however, slavery was a very contentious issue, even as the Constitution was being written, and the division was largely a geographic one. States in the South heavily relied upon plantations and agriculture. They were strong supporters of slavery as a cornerstone of their economies, but the more industrial and cosmopolitan northern states were less reliant on slavery and also, you know, a little bit more forward in their thinking, and so were more prone to abolitionism. Now, that's not to say that Northerners weren't racist as all hell. They were. African Americans, slave or not, weren't treated particularly well by most white Americans, no matter where they went. But in the North, at least, people there weren't as inclined to subject other people to a lifetime of bondage. And it's important to note here as well, right, that many of the people in the North didn't consider themselves necessarily abolitionists. They may have disagreed with the institution of slavery, right? But rather than being abolitionists, they had a real, like, NIMBY thing going on, right? Not in my backyard. They didn't want to deal with slavery. They didn't want slavery in their state. They didn't want slavery to expand further throughout the United States. But, well, you know, it exists down the South. We can't do anything about it as long as we don't have it propagate any further. There were a lot of people who took this line. This was probably, I would say, the at least earlier on in the United States history, this was the prevailing thought amongst many of the people in the northern states. They may not have been hardline abolitionists. They may have been anti-slavery in that they didn't want it in their states, but were willing to tolerate it in other parts of the country, but not in new states, as we'll come to. Anyway, efforts were made by anti-slavery groups to limit or curtail slavery in the United States. As I mentioned, in 1794, Washington, who was a slave owner himself, let's not forget, he signed into law the Slave Trade Act. This forbade slave ships from being built or outfitted in the United States. And then later on in 1807, another slave-owning president, Thomas Jefferson, he approved the Act Prohibiting the Importation of Slaves, another very important step towards the ultimate abolition of the international slave trade. However, this law didn't address the internal domestic slave trade within the United States, and as a result, generations of enslaved African Americans, their ancestors having been forcibly removed from their homes across the Atlantic, continued to toil and labor for their entire lives. Many northern states did abolish slavery outright. The number of freed African Americans grew steadily as time passed. But slavery was still a very, very big part of the United States. All the way through to the outset and the resolution of the Civil War, the majority of sitting presidents owned slaves, and it was seen as a very necessary part of the United States' economic well-being, not just by people who were ardent pro-slavery campaigners in the South, but people in the North who once again were happy for it to exist, just not in my backyard. The further south you went, however, the worse it became. Into the 19th century, the demand for slave labour in the southern states only increased and increased, of course, as more and more land was settled and cultivated. And you can see by now how interrelated all of these issues are, right? The foreign policy, the westward expansion, slavery, all these things go hand in hand, but are worth discussing on their own so you can understand the ways in which they connect and the ways in which they inform one another. In time, the total population of slaves across the United States would rise as high as 4 million. And as more and more land was settled, as the demand for unfree labor rose and rose, and southern states unapologetically defended what became known as the United States' peculiar institution. Slavers argued that slavery was a necessary evil. It propped up the southern economies and the cash crops that in turn benefited the Union as a whole. They argued that freed slaves would be dangerous, that racial divisions would lead to social unrest and potential social collapse. And so African Americans had to remain enslaved for the safety of everyone, according to these people. They also argued that slavery was, in the end, actually good for those who were enslaved, if you'll believe it. They were better off in the US than they would have been back in Africa with, you know, all of the advancements of civilized society like whips and chains. If slaves were to be cared for properly by their owners, slavers argued, then they were better off than freed laborers even. They had a guarantee of a roof over their head and food in their bellies. Again, never mind the whips and chains, I suppose, or the back-breaking labor that was somehow for these poor souls' own good. Slavers argued that without an underclass of slaves, society would never progress. The wealth that slaves generated enabled everyone else to enjoy progress and prosperity. And that may be true, but what of the people who are, again, toiling away in the fields for their entire lives, never being given a glimpse or a hope of freedom? These were the arguments that were expounded and thoroughly believed by the pro-slavery camp, in addition to what is perhaps one of the most pervasive and damaging arguments in favor of slavery, one that, even if it's not being used to support slavery explicitly these days, is still very much alive and kicking today in certain parts of the world. The idea that, the argument that black people were, and in some people's minds still are, necessarily inferior to white people, and that this inferiority rendered them unfit for any role in American society other than slavery. Now, I trust I don't need to rebut these arguments for you. I trust I don't need to enumerate the arguments put forth by the abolitionists and those who stood against slavery. I would consider them to be largely self-evident. Slavery is, it should go without saying, a great and terrible evil. And is by no means unique to the United States as well. Slavery has stained the collective consciences of far too many civilizations throughout the broad sweep of history, but in the 19th century, continued acceptance of such a barbaric and primitive institution, such a morally reprehensible practice, was wearing very thin across much of the world, and the United States was well behind the times in persisting in its support of slavery. As it stood with the existing states at the time, there was an uneasy equilibrium. As the years continued, slavery was abolished in the northern states, but continued in the southern states. Now, that wasn't the issue. It wasn't about the southern states and the northern states. That wasn't the crux or the focus of the issue of slavery within the United States. It was about new states as they were admitted to the Union. As the United States expanded, as more and more states were admitted to the Union, fierce debate would erupt as to whether these new states, particularly those towards the center of the North-South divide, would be slave states or would be free states. Now, in some instances, it became very obvious when divided along geographic lines. Southern states like Louisiana, Mississippi, Georgia, and the like, they were admitted as slave states, while northern states like Illinois, Ohio, and Maine, these were admitted as free states, often in a sort of tit-for-tat deal, right? You get one free state, you get one slave state. But in states between the North and the South in states like Kentucky, Missouri, Kansas. Slavery was the most controversial and contentious political issue of the time. In the late 1840s and into the 1850s, tension grew and grew between pro- and anti-slavery camps, ratcheted up further and further whenever a new state was admitted to the Union. Both sides feared that if too many states of the opposing view joined the US, then they would be able to force their agenda through by dominating Congress. And this was the reason behind this tit-for-tat admission of free states and slave states. And this fear of being outnumbered by their political opponents, by the opposing faction, this fear actually, as it turned out, ended up being very legitimate. Across a decade of conflict over the issue of slavery in the 1850s, the Anti-Slavery Republican Party was formed. As reprehensible and as backwards as the policies of the modern-day Republican Party are, the Republican Party of the 19th century was very different indeed. Standing against slavery, the Republicans were the party of big government, believe it or not, expanded federal powers, economic regulation, and increased government spending. A far cry from the Republican Party of today. We'll come to the dramatic shift in political party alignment in a future episode, but for now, in the 1850s, we can clearly see that the third party system was established. On one side, the anti-slavery big government Republicans. On the other side, the pro-slavery small government Democrats that came in the wake of Jackson. How these parties essentially switched positions over the next century is a very interesting tale, but again, it's one we'll get to in coming weeks. As it was, across the 1850s, these political factions were on a collision course, and the enormous amount of political tension that had built up across the decade finally snapped in 1860. I mentioned just earlier how these factions had a very legitimate fear of being outnumbered and therefore drowned out in Congress. That, as it happens, is exactly what took place. Bolstered by widespread support across the northern free states, in the 1860 presidential elections, the Republican Abraham Lincoln was duly elected, and realizing the existential threat that an anti-slavery Republican president posed to their slave-based economies, seven southern states seceded from the Union in February 1861 and were followed by another four in April after the official outbreak of the American Civil War. The American Civil War began when these seceding states, calling themselves the Confederate States of America, attacked a U.S. fort, Fort Sumter, found in South Carolina, on the 12th of April 1861. They were joined, as I say, by four more, and these 11 secessionist states went up against the Union, led by Abraham Lincoln. And so began a terrible and a bloody chapter in the history of the United States, as Lincoln mobilized the Union Army, firstly, to defend from the Confederate attacks, and then to preserve the Union and bring the secessionist Confederate states to heel. There is an enormous amount of information out there about the Civil War that is, to put it very simply, patently untrue, most notably about the reasons why it was fought. And that's what I want to focus on here as we talk about the Civil War. Not so much the what of the war, because there is an infinite amount of content about that out there, but the why of the war. For instance, on the side of Lincoln, when it comes to Lincoln and his objectives in fighting the Civil War, his absolute top priority was not the emancipation of slaves. It was to preserve the Union. While the Republican Party was anti-slavery, certainly, I certainly wouldn't go so far as to call them abolitionist. As I mentioned before, abolitionism wasn't thoroughly widespread throughout the northern free states, and the Republican Party was more interested in preventing the further expansion of slavery into new parts of the US at the outbreak of the war than they were with the abolition of slavery wholesale. And Lincoln, for his part, he openly said that the emancipation of slaves was secondary to his objectives of preserving the Union. Here is a direct quote from Lincoln himself. "My paramount objective in this struggle is to save the Union, and it is not either to save or to destroy slavery. If I could save the Union without freeing any slaves, I would do it. And if I could save it by freeing all the slaves, I would do it. And if I could save it by freeing some and leaving others alone, I would also do that. I want to point this out because it seemingly runs contrary to one of the most pervasive and dangerous narratives out there about the Civil War and its causes. Often Lincoln is, and you know, to an extent rightly, championed as a hero to the enslaved people of the United States, ultimately issuing the Emancipation Proclamation and paving the way for the total abolition of slavery across the US. But I think it's important to note that even for him, this was a secondary issue, because his primary concern was with saving the Union, with preserving the United States of America as it stood. And this fact is often used as evidence for an extremely dangerous narrative, as I've said, that is pushed about the Civil War. And the fact that Lincoln was more concerned with preserving the Union than he was with abolishing slavery does not in any way undermine the rebuttal that you should offer to people who are going to tell you that the Civil War was not about slavery. In many parts of the southern US, people are very proud of their region's involvement in the Civil War. They talk about heritage and their way of life and invoke other smoke screens to distract you from the true cause of the war. I can't make it any clearer than this. The American Civil War was about slavery, pure and simple. And to say anything else is to be willfully and disgracefully dishonest. Sure, for Lincoln, it wasn't all about slavery. It was about preserving the Union. But the only reason that he had to preserve the Union in the first place is because it shattered in two over the issue of slavery. Those who today proudly display the Confederate battle flag, perhaps not even knowing that it was never the official flag of the Confederate States of America, they will often talk about how the Civil War was fought due to ongoing economic disputes between the North and the South, due to the political overreach of all the politicians in Washington, due to the cultural differences between Yankee and Dixie America. They put forward the mythology of the lost cause, this nonsense idea that the Northern states were engaged in an oppressive crusade against the South's heritage and way of life, that the Civil War was a noble struggle to defend the Southern states from the tyrannical North. And these people will all too often bring up the very same reason, the same despicably misleading, willfully dishonest, historical revisionist reason to explain why the war occurred. And it simply is not true. These people will tell you that it wasn't about slavery, that it was instead about states' rights. Okay, sure. A state's right to do what, exactly? A state's right to do what? It incenses me to see people today defend a repressive, backwards, tinpot regime whose entire existence was devoted to the propagation of one of humanity's very worst crimes. Do not believe the lies of these people and do not enable or accept their defense of a despicable regime that, when all is said and done, lasted for a grand total of 4 years and 3 months. The average tin of tuna at the supermarket has a longer shelf life than the Confederate States of America. And a tin of tuna comes with the added bonus of not trying to defend slavery. It is time for the South to move on. I do not understand why people across the Southern state are proudly flying the colors of the Confederate States of America years and years later in celebration of a failed state committed to an unforgivable creed. It's a very bloody good thing that they lost. After the outbreak of the American Civil War, the Union pursued military campaigns in the west of the Confederacy pretty effectively, although they struggled further to the east. Confederate General Robert E. Lee did a pretty good job of holding the Union off to the east, particularly in the Union's efforts to capture the Confederate capital of Richmond in Virginia. The Union took control of the border states in 1862 and then pressed the attack against the Confederates later in that year. Lincoln threatened that he would emancipate all the slaves in the southern states unless the Confederates surrendered. They did not. And so, on the 1st of January 1863, Lincoln issued the Emancipation Proclamation. This proclamation, on paper at least, permanently and immediately freed 3.5 million states across the Confederate States of America and allowed for any freed slaves who managed to make it to the Union lines to come and join the Union Army and continue the fight. This galvanized the Union, particularly amongst the hardline abolitionists, and brought Lincoln new allies by firming up his anti-slavery position, one that was, I will remind you, one of pragmatism rather than idealism. But hey, it worked. We'll take it. The war's turning point came in July 1863, when the Confederates were beaten in the Battle of Gettysburg, after which Lincoln made his famous Gettysburg Address. And then, still in July, Union General and future President Ulysses S. Grant, he took control of the Mississippi River. And this divided the Confederacy in two, and things went from bad to worse for them afterwards, with a full-scale Union invasion into 1864. The Union was so far ahead of the Confederacy in terms of things like industrialization, logistics, manpower, and even just wealth. They were able to mobilize and transport armies on a network of railroads. They were able to create war material in their enormous factories. And while they were doing this, Union General Sherman was ravaging the southern cities and plantations, burning and razing them to the ground. Eventually, the Confederacy was ground down, unable to cope with this war of attrition, unable to keep pace with the Union, and so General Lee finally surrendered to General Grant after the Battle of Appomattox Courthouse on the 9th of April, 1865. Officially, however, the war wouldn't end until May, and tragically, Lincoln wouldn't live to see the end of it. Less than a week after Lee's surrender, Lincoln was assassinated at Ford's Theatre in Washington, D.C. on the 15th of April, by Confederate sympathizer John Wilkes Booth, who was, as you may know, quite a famous actor of all things. And what's more, he was the brother of an even more famous actor. It'd be a bit like these days Casey Affleck assassinating the president. He's obviously not quite as famous as Ben, but you know, you've still heard of him. But poor old Lincoln, who ended up giving his life as part of his quest to save the Union, he was one of hundreds of thousands of casualties of the American Civil War. The American Civil War is the bloodiest and deadliest war in US history, with around 750,000 soldiers dying. It was deadlier even than the Second World War was for the United States, in which around 420,000 American soldiers died. However, in the wake of the Civil War, slavery was no more. Thanks to the Emancipation Proclamation and the following 13th Amendment to the US Constitution, slavery was, at long last, abolished throughout the United States. And while the Union persisted, while the United States of America continued on, it was left to heal the wounds caused as North fought South, as state fought state, as the Civil War split the nation in two. But these wounds were deep, very deep, and some of them remain unhealed to this very day. Immediately following the Civil War, the United States entered a period of history known as Reconstruction, where the country attempted to rebuild after the war and deal with the issues that arose with the freeing of millions of slaves and the reintegration of rebel states and their populations. And it's there that we'll pick up the story next week as the US hurtled towards the 20th century and, of course, the world wars that came with it. Reconstruction, continued westward settlement, the progressive era, the world wars, the Great Depression, the New Deal, so much more to get across next week. So I hope you'll join me once again to continue the story of the United States of America. But that's it. That's all she wrote today, sports fans. Well, for this week at least. I'm looking forward to coming back next week for more US history. And I'm also very pleased to hear from listeners who say they're enjoying me tackling a much larger topic in a bit more depth. We've, again, never done a four-part series before, but I'm very pleased to hear that some people at least are enjoying it. And for those who aren't, well, you know, it'll be over eventually, and we'll be back to the one-and-done routine that you're so very used to. But I do want to thank all the people who got in touch with their feedback. You can join them, too, if you want to let me know what you think of this episode and any others. Halfasshistory.net. Use the contact form there. That's the best way to get in touch with me. You can use the email in the show description, but the best way is the contact form. I'm guaranteed to read all those emails no matter what. And it's also the place to suggest topics, although I do have obviously topics lined up for the next couple of weeks, but always keen to hear more, especially for quarter ass history or anything else that's come across your desk. I'd love to get across it. I want to thank everyone as well who's jumping on the various social media platforms on TikTok, on Instagram, on Facebook, on Twitter or X. You can find the show, it's just Half-Assed History on all of those platforms, except on Twitter where it's Half-Assed Histore with no Y, wouldn't fit, very annoying. But, you know, do be sure to head over there and, you know, like, comment and subscribe. I know we all say it, I'm so sorry to be doing it to you. But look, people who know a lot more about this sort of thing than me are saying that it's going to have a very big difference for the show. So if you want to support the show, it's a way you can do it. In addition to, of course, leaving reviews. I think that's actually really helped, particularly on Spotify, where there's just a huge, huge number of reviews that have come in. So if you want to do that, Spotify or on Apple Podcasts, wherever you take your fancy, these reviews are immensely appreciated, as indeed are all of the comments on all the social media channels begging someone to give me a book deal. I'm working on it. Anyway, thanks for listening. Tell your friends, tell your enemies, tell people about whom you feel largely ambivalent. It is a very good way to support the show, as indeed is joining the show's Patreon, patreon.com/halfasshistory. You can sign up and gain all sorts of stuff, early access, show notes, uncut episodes, and of course, ad-free listening for those of you who may enjoy that. It's going to be available there on patreon.com for you. And a deep, deep debt of gratitude is owed to all the patrons, old and new alike, for their continued support. And speaking of new patrons, why don't I let you know who's joined up this week? And I'm very pleased to say there's been quite a haul. Martin Stannard, Kieran Tierney, Paul Nesbitt, Paul Ahlers, Robert Van Beek, Jim Bowserman, and most excitingly, Riley Curry. Great to have another Riley along. I believe one of the first Rileys to jump over onto patreon.com/halfasshistory. So if you're a freeloader Riley out there, I tell you what, why not lend a hand to a fellow Riley? That's my very specific pitch for this week. I shouldn't be doing that. I should be going, if your name is, I don't know what, John or I don't know, Sarah, you know, just really, really common names. Great names, of course, great. Love those names, but come on. Riley's in a category of its own. Anyway, cheers, Riley. Cheers, everyone else who's signed up this week. And if you want to follow in their footsteps, patreon.com/halfasshistory. Anyway, it's been a bloody long episode, and I'm happy to wrap it up here and now with a question posed on Reddit, of course. See you next week for more US history. Until then, leaving you with a question posed by Twister Up Rocker, who asks, why did all of the Civil War battles happen in places with national parks and monuments?
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.